In case you didn't take AP Government in high school, and I wouldn't expect a glowing review from Miss Leach on my performance, so I'm basically with you there, let me introduce a core concept that very much applies here. It's called majority rule, and it's what it sounds like. In a democracy like ours, which we do not have time to address right now, it's the idea that a bigger number of people should get a bigger say in decisions. As I'm sure you know by now, though, college sports are a far cry from simple, and they are not a democracy. The overwhelming majority of all college athletes, and we really are talking about roughly 99% of the total here, have basically nothing to do with the experience of football and basketball players in the Power 5 conferences. And they definitely aren't the ones calling the shots. They are largely along for the ride. College sports do run on a majority rule, just not the AP Gov kind. More the AP Econ kind. I didn't excel in that either, but this isn't about me, okay? The majority rule in college sports is who has the majority of the money, and you probably don't need two guesses to get who that is. This is The Option, Episode 5, Majority Rule. I think it's fair to say that we focus more on the case against the NCAA model so far, which, you know, that'll happen, but there does remain a case for it when it comes to the broader picture. Many firmly believe that the educational mission is still the most important thing in college sports, because that 1 to 99% split applies to something else, too. Take it from the NCAA.
The NCAA and its member schools offer nearly 500,000 college athletes a path to go pro in something other than sports.
Hardly anyone goes pro. For the vast majority of college athletes, that's just not going to be their career. And that's front of mind for those who are more critical of the way things seem to be headed in college sports. Those like former college basketball player Cody McDavis, who we heard from way back in episode 1. Remember that, like 2 hours ago?
What does that mean for an education that's already getting diluted today? When we hear about these paper classes and we hear about all these other things that are going on where your education is shallow, it is superficial because we've gotten so focused on the sports, what does that mean for the 99%, 98% of student athletes who are not gonna go pro in their sport? Are they prepared to go out there and actually compete in the real world where all of us exist? Do we lose that when we start talking about compensating, again, the Zion Williamsons, all the top student athletes who are going to go make millions of dollars anyway? Why are we changing the whole paradigm for the exception?
And just to be doubly clear, the whole paradigm means a lot of different things. First, even when it comes to the sports in which athletes can make life-changing money playing pro, those opportunities are very limited. The NCAA puts out hard data on this. Baseball and hockey are your best bets, but the odds aren't in your favor there either. In both football and basketball, men and women's, your chances hover around 1%. For individual sports like golf and tennis, those odds are even lower. Here's Abby Forbes, who won a national championship with UNC's women's tennis team last year.
The reality is, even on my team, as successful as we are, only a portion of us are going to go pro. Representing that same statistic that we all see, the less than 1% of athletes who end up going pro.
And for strictly Olympic sports like swimming or wrestling, the odds of making it to that level are just as low, maybe lower, even if you do make it, unless you're a hugely popular Olympian like a Michael Phelps or a Simone Biles who signs a bunch of endorsement deals, you're not going to make huge sums of money off your career. It's no fun crushing dreams, but that's just how it is. And from my perspective, that makes the case for NIL right there. These careers don't always last very long, and if you work your whole life to be good enough at a sport to play it in college, you should be able to make what you can of that talent. It's a limit that we don't put on anyone else. Former Arizona State swimmer Grant House, who some of you may know as the lead plaintiff in the high-profile legal case, House v. NCAA, says it was talking to some music students that first set the light bulb off.
I remember one night they were talking and they're like, yeah, isn't it like crazy we could do this, but and you could be even better than us, but you couldn't make any money off of it? And I was like, wait a second, like what? Like it just sat in my head for a second and I was like, that's weird. And then I was like, kind of like, say it again. We ran through and he's like, yeah, like you're an athlete. We could make millions of records. We could sell like a Billboard top 100. And you could do a Billboard top 10 and you wouldn't be able to make any money because you're an athlete. And I was like, well, that's just like limiting someone's talents and abilities. I feel like that doesn't seem right to me.
For the longest time, there was all this red tape and NCAA compliance measures around a college athlete even being paid to coach their sport, which seems especially absurd in retrospect. Playing a sport at the D1 level is a massive time commitment. It is an outsized part of your life. The fact that athletes couldn't then go and make the most of the skill they spend the most time practicing, like, say, a musician, struck a lot of people as pretty unfair.
They always talk about, we want to put our student athletes in the best position. It's like, well, are you letting them optimize everything they can do in college? And up until last year, 2 years, it was no. Like, it was fill out your resume, get your job. It's like, well, how am I supposed to fill out a resume when I'm traveling every weekend? I'm training 20 hours a week, 20 plus hours a week, recovering probably at least 10 hours a week, schoolwork, attending class, eating, sleeping. And at the end, I'm supposed to go and build this resume. Like, that's a pretty high daunting task to put on any young person.
So as much as the emergence of NIL combined with the transfer portal has turned the world of college sports upside down, it's also turned stuff like that right side up. Abby Forbes says the ability for college tennis players to make money while they're in school is helping make the sport better, mainly because promising young players don't have to worry as much about holding back their career by attending school.
And of course, NIL is also changing the game on that. Now there's no risk. There's very little, at least. It used to really be that, number one, they couldn't make money if they went to college. And number two, they felt like the level of college tennis wasn't at the level that it needed to be to go on the pro tour. That is no longer the case. There's a long list of college tennis players who are either top 100 in the world, have won grand slams. From the University of North Carolina in particular, we have Rinki Hijikata, who won the Australian Open doubles championship last year. We have so many examples of college tennis players who, coming from college, had the level that they needed to go on the pro tour.
And I do have to note here, the idea that more people would be going and getting an education sounds exactly like what universities and the NCAA would want to be happening. What Abby hopes for, though, is that it doesn't have to be an either or.
But I wish that we would also see stats as for what companies are student athletes going to go work for? Are they starting their own organizations? Because the less than 1%, they're going pro. But nobody ever talks about what the 99% are doing. I have some teammates who are going to be doctors. I have some teammates who are going to be in advertising and PR. They're going into consulting positions. They're doing all these amazing things, whether it be advocacy. I've dabbled in a bunch of different things because doors were opened for me. I think that motivating athletic departments to start focusing on how the athlete is doing in the area that they want to succeed in might not only make the athletes play better and in turn do better for the school and make them more money, but I think it would also motivate more people to go to that school that produces those stats.
And again, she's talking about ideas that the NCAA has long championed. The fear here, setting NIL aside to some extent, is that the push for an even more sweeping systemic change, yes, we're back to the revenue sharing idea, will endanger all of this by pulling the funding out from a lot of programs that rely on football and basketball to pay the bills. I think we should take that seriously. Nobody wants to see schools shuttering programs. What struck me in talking to Grant and Abby, though, was how they both believe that risk could be mitigated. Grant calls it, more than anything, a failure of imagination.
And I think that's where we're having a really big lapse and a really big issue with this threshold that we're pressing against right now is there are ways to make college swimming very lucrative. There are ways to make college hockey very lucrative. And we just haven't had to make it a necessity.
Abby says much the same. There's a way to do this. It's not tested because it hasn't had to be, but there's reason to believe it could be done to a meaningful degree.
At the end of the day, a sport like tennis will never bring in as much revenue as football or basketball just because of prestige and history. However, I do believe that there's an opportunity for some of these non-revenue sports like tennis or another very specific sport here at UNC, like a field hockey, right? Those sports can and will start bringing in revenue if that opportunity presented itself from the athletic department.
There are schools and programs that are already doing this now. Take the Nebraska women's volleyball program, which rightly made so many headlines this past fall for packing the football stadium.
Memorial Stadium's official attendance last night was 92,003. The Cornhuskers say that's a new world record for attendance at a women's sporting event. It's also bigger than any football crowd that's ever filled this century-old stadium.
Now, others might tell you it's still not that simple. That Nebraska program is an outlier, and what it's able to pull off just isn't true of other programs. Or it might be possible at big D1 schools like Nebraska, but that kind of thing would never be feasible at smaller schools with tighter budgets. There is truth to all of that. But what you do hear a lot of, which makes it especially important for us to touch on, is the notion that one category of sport is at particular risk when and if the larger system does change. Women's sports.
And then they always throw in Title IX. They always say, we're going to have to cut the women's sports, you know.
Amanda Kristovich from Front Office Sports.
And technically that's true based on the way the money currently flows, because the way the athletic department set it up is that all the revenue they make from football and men's basketball is what they use to subsidize all the women's and Olympic sports. That doesn't mean it has to be that way.
We've mentioned it several times now, but Title IX warrants a deeper look for a lot of reasons. So first off, we should just set out what it is. It's a federal civil rights law passed in 1972 that applies to any and all entities that receive federal money. That covers a lot more than schools, but for our purposes, it applies to universities. And what it applies is a far-reaching ban on discrimination by sex. You, early 1970s university, can no longer discriminate against your female students in favor of your male students. That covers a lot more than sports, very notably including course offerings. But again, for our purposes, what the law did was make university athletic departments provide equitable opportunities for women to compete in sports. If you had a football team, as many schools did, a sport exclusively played by men, then you needed to field women's teams to balance that out.
And I think what you started to see initially was, well, what sports do we start sponsoring? And one of them at a pretty high level was volleyball.
That's Jamie Gordon, the head of the American Volleyball Coaches Association. Told you we'd hear from him again.
You know, volleyball, I think, in all honesty, found a good way to connect itself to football. As like, okay, well, we have men's and women's basketball. Where does volleyball fit?
Title IX is how that wildly successful Nebraska program came to be. It's why most volleyball programs exist, as well as a slew of other sports like women's soccer, field hockey, and gymnastics, as schools rush to field teams that would balance out all the resources and scholarships they were already putting towards men's sports. That law changed America forever, and obviously for the better.
It is, yeah. I think, the most important law in our country the last 50 years.
Longtime USA Today columnist Christine Brennan.
And the United States has fallen in love with that law. We just don't like it. We love it. Oh, my goodness. I mean, the reddest of the red states, wherever, Mississippi, Alabama, politically. The dads and moms there love Title IX. They're out, you know, hiring the pitching coach for their sixth grade daughter so that she can be the greatest pitcher ever and get a college scholarship and go on to play NCAA softball. And on it goes with soccer and volleyball and so many other sports. And so that is one of the great success stories in our nation, not just the last 50, 51 years, but throughout the nation, the cultural success of how we have embraced women and girls sports and what we produced in terms of women who will lead the country.
It was an absolutely revolutionary shift, the single biggest driving force in the emergence of women's sports in America. And its impact, to be doubly clear, is far more good than not. But it has been far from perfect, because any law is only as good as the way it's enforced. And Title IX has never had much oomph behind it. I'd liken it to the UN. We can condemn you, but we can't force you to do much. That, I think, has consequences. And when you look around the world of college sports today, you certainly don't see equal treatment. Many of you will probably remember the scandal around the women's basketball national championships a few years ago. And if you're wondering why I'm not calling it Women's March Madness, it's because, prior to that scandal, the NCAA refused to even use that branding for the women's tournament. So, by way of demonstration, this is what got them to change their tune.
I got something to show y'all.
That's Sedona Prince, a basketball player at the University of Oregon at the time.
So for the NCAA March Madness, the biggest tournament in college basketball for women, this is our weight room.
It doesn't hit quite the same here on audio, so let me give you a visual aid real quick. The women's gym is a single rack of dinky dumbbells, like you put in your garage around New Year's resolutions time.
Let me show y'all the men's weight room.
The men's gym is a sprawling facility that looks, well, like an actual gym. All kinds of weights, a bunch of machines, ton of space. A CrossFitter's dream.
Now, when pictures of our weight room got released versus the men's, the NCAA came out with a statement saying that it wasn't money, it was space that was a problem. Let me show y'all something else. Here's our practice court, right? And then here's that weight room. And then here's all this extra space. If you aren't upset about this problem, then you're a part of it.
To put it mildly, this was a bad look for Mark Emmert and company in Indianapolis. It probably helped bring his tenure to an end, and it led to a very public gender equity review, which revealed, among other things, that the NCAA had massively undersold the media rights for the women's tournament. The review projected that the contract to broadcast that tournament would actually be worth over 14 times more than what the NCAA was getting for it. And a new deal with ESPN to broadcast that championship, among a host of others, reflected that shift.
The NCAA and ESPN have reached a new 8-year media rights deal worth more than $115 million annually. That is roughly 3 times the annual value of the current 14-year deal. Sports agency giant Endeavor, which consulted for the NCAA on the deal, said about 57% of the value of the deal is tied to women's college basketball.
You might have noticed that 3 times is not quite 14 times, and many had called for Women's March Madness to get its own separate contract since it was the most valuable property. So some were disappointed by the announcement, but it's still a sign of serious growth in women's sports, particularly basketball, in a relatively short period. Reasonable people can disagree on what this all might amount to in the end. If more football and basketball money starts staying with those sports, then athletic departments all over the country would have to figure out how to balance new and wildly different books. They're the ones who've warned that women's sports could be threatened by that shift. For Amanda Kristovich and others we spoke to, that threat isn't totally illegitimate, but it may be overblown.
If you go on the Department of Education data and you look at how much money these teams are bringing in, there are Pac-12 softball programs that bring in $7 million a year. Explain to me how that's not profitable. Explain to me what you are doing with that money that means you still need subsidies from somewhere else in your budget line.
On the other hand, Christine Brennan notes that while real damage to women's sports is not a sure thing, she's worried about a big step back right when they seem to be hitting their stride.
I would look at every conference leader, every university leader, and I would say, you need to be aware right now of what could happen. And you want to be known as the people who damaged women's sports when it is in its heyday. And it's not just, although this by itself is enough, it's not just that, it's also the U.S. Olympic effort. And we are kidding ourselves if we think that just by throwing money at football to the detriment of so many Olympic sports on college campuses, we're kidding ourselves if we think then we're still going to go ahead and beat China and, everybody else in Olympic medal counts.
And that concern from Brennan brings us to the other core constituency that's thought to be at risk here, Olympic sports. See, America doesn't do the Olympic Games like the rest of the world. We're the only country that doesn't back its Olympic team with government funds. There is no Ministry of Sports here. That is all outsourced, folks, right to your campus and mine. College is our system, as Arizona State's Victoria Jackson explains here.
Sports in schools have been serving the function of Olympic development in the United States by default. So this has never been intentional, but it's what college sports has become. It's become the best Olympic development system in the world and for the world's athletes.
And look, it's hard to argue with the results. Right around 2 out of every 3 Olympics in modern history, the U.S. has finished with the most medals. So based on that, plenty of people think the way we do this is a good thing. And I don't even disagree with that, really. But it does leave them more vulnerable than they otherwise would be to shifts in the wider landscape of college sports. they're more exposed. And since those shifts seem to be coming, those like Jackson think now is the time to change our model accordingly.
We're the only country in the world that does not have publicly subsidized Olympic development. It's private in the US, but it can be private because we've been relying on colleges. And so I think there's a really good opportunity to make an argument that now is the time to introduce public subsidization. There's federal monies running through colleges in all sorts of ways. You can have federal monies for Olympic development running through colleges too. And then you open up those college facilities, which have been very narrowly focused for college sports, to Olympic development athletes.
That could help in theory, and there are some schools that probably wouldn't need that help. Many of these big state schools are operating athletic departments in the hundreds of millions of dollars, but they're a part of institutions running on multi-billion dollar budgets. And you do have to think, in those cases, there must be some wiggle room to keep fielding sports programs. But just like there are 1% athletes and 99% athletes, there are 1% schools and 99% schools. And even within that hallowed 1%, college athletic debt has been soaring for a long time now. It's like we talked about in our first episode. It is spend, 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 with little to no financial discipline baked in. Schools like Cal Berkeley, the University of Illinois, Arizona State, Texas A&M, all of them and more have humongous debt loads. The two teams that just played for football's national championship, Michigan and Washington, are both carrying well over $200 million in outstanding athletic debts. This got out of hand a long time ago. Big-time universities won't be coming to me for accounting help, not after hearing that quip I made about AP Econ earlier. But if they did, I'd probably tell them something like this. There are some untested free market principles here that ought to appeal to those of you that did get A's in that class. And if these departments and programs were to be tested, then maybe, just maybe, they would rise to the occasion. I'd certainly like to think so, and we might find out sooner than later. We'll get back to that big question, where we go from here, next time on The Option. The music you heard in this episode comes from Epidemic Sounds. Production and sound editing by Joe Engelbrecht and Dean Metherill. Cover art by Sam Ball. And I'm your host, Michael Hendricks. Catch you next time.